In the 1960s, he urged students at Columbia University to burn their college to the ground. Today, he's chair of their School of Arts Film Division. Jamal Joseph's personal odyssey from the streets of Harlem to Rikers Island and Leavenworth to the halls of Columbia is as gripping as it is inspiring. Eddie Joseph was a high school honor student slated to graduate early and begin college, but it was the late 1960s in Bronx's Black Ghetto, and 15-year-old Eddie was introduced to the tenets of the Black Panther Party, which was just gaining a national foothold. By 16, his devotion to the cause landed him in prison, charged with conspiracy as one of the Panther 21. When exonerated, Eddie, now called Jamal, became the youngest spokesperson and leader of the Panthers' New York chapter. He joined the Revolutionary Underground, later landing back in prison. Sentenced to more than 12 years in Leavenworth, he earned 3 degrees there and found a new calling. As I mentioned, he's now chair of Columbia University's School of the Arts Film Division. He tells his story in the new book, Panther Baby, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Jamal Joseph to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. A great pleasure.
Oh, thank you, Joe. Good morning to you and to your listeners.
A wonderful treat to have you with us. The subtitle of the book is A Life of Rebellion and Reinvention. I want to talk about the rebellion at first. Do you feel prior to the age of 15 that you had rebellion in you, that you were a rebellious youth?
I was a really good kid who was a Cub Scout and who went camping, who was a choir boy, who was an honor student. But I was raised by adoptive grandparents that made me aware of what a tense, sometimes hateful and dangerous place that America could be for black people and for young black men. They took me in when they were older, and so their parents had been slaves, and their older siblings had been slaves, and so they were both from the South. And I would hear stories, their first-person accounts of beatings, of lynchings, of the Ku Klux Klans, of cross burnings, of an America, especially in the South, where if a black person was coming down the street and a white person was on the sidewalk, that black person had to step into the street. And if it was raining and muddy and it was a black grandmother and the white person was a white teenager, then grandmother was just going to get her shoes muddy that day. And they had been not highly educated people in terms of formal education, but highly informed people. They came to New York, they got involved in Garvey's Back to Africa movement and then the NAACP, and they had me involved in the NAACP Youth Council from when I was a kid. So in the civil rights movement, in terms of, you know, going to rallies and hearing about lynchings and beatings that were still going on in the South, and those images of people who were protesting peacefully being attacked by police dogs and cattle prods, and then people would come, civil rights workers would come to talk at community centers and black churches, and so you would get first-person accounts of things that were going on. I was clearly aware that there was a divide. And then also, even as a good kid, we had encounters with white police. I mean, there were incidents where we would climb into the park to play basketball after the park was officially closed, and white cops would come and smack us around and sometimes whack us, you know, across our legs with nightsticks to make us run home. We'd be running home, and if one of our friends were kind of crying and sniffling, we would say, oh, you were crying, you couldn't take it. And our friend would go, I'm not crying. And we were conditioned to take it. So our response wasn't even a realization that we had just been victimized by white police officers, that they had essentially broken the law, but that, boy, we need to learn how to take that.
You speak of that conditioning, and I just have to wonder, of given the time and given the context of your childhood and growing up, did you feel anger, and when did that start to manifest itself?
Well, the anger came, the moment that kind of crystallized things for me was when Dr. King was killed.
Right.
I grew up in a neighborhood that was a working class or poor working class neighborhood where you saw the frustration on the street corners of guys hanging out who couldn't get a job and who thought that and couldn't get into college and thought that, well, I might as well, you know, join the Army and go to Vietnam. And then, you know, the community center I went to was in Harlem. So you felt that frustration and that tension in the community. When Dr. King was killed, I was 15 years old, and then I really got angry. It's like something went off inside of me, like a little, you know, water balloon of emotion just burst in my chest. And I went down to my grandparents. Well, it was just grandma by that time. Granddad had died. And I went to 125th Street and was on the fringes of the riots, and then came back the next day and just announced to my friends who I ate lunch with every day at school that I was going to be a black militant. And one of my best friends was a white kid, a Jewish kid named Paul Kirshner. And he said, Eddie, I don't know if you can announce that you're going to be a black militant like it's a career choice. Like you're going to be a doctor or a lawyer. I was like, no, Paul, you watch.
I'll show you.
I'm going to be a militant. So it was almost like a dare to prove to Paul as much as anybody else that I then had to find the most militant organization around, which turned out to be the Black Panther Party.
And you write in the book about how, about your relationship in those early days with the Panthers, about how they gave you books, they wanted you to read, they wanted to have you learn about history, they wanted you to understand and develop a respect of women and family, and it seems in some cases there were very positive elements to that training.
Well, yeah, and this was contrary to what I thought I was getting into, because, remember, it wasn't very scientific or objective in terms of choosing the Panthers.
Right.
It was that Dr. King had been murdered, and there were these images of every time people tried to protest peacefully, you know, they were attacked, and so that now it was time to fight back. And I just saw this image of the Panthers on TV when they stormed the state capitol in Sacramento with guns in protest of the changing gun control laws in California. Panthers would patrol the streets of Oakland with shotguns and law books, and the guns were legal. And it made national news, and I thought they were crazy, but I also thought they were very cool. These guys with the leather coats and the guns saying, we have a constitutional right to bear arms to fight white oppression. So we took this long train ride out to Brooklyn. There wasn't a Panther office in the Bronx or Harlem. And my older friends kind of psyched me out to believe that I had to prove myself, probably by getting a gun and killing a white dude that very day. I'm scared to death because I'm this choir boy and this honor student. And we walk into the office, and we're in a meeting where the person is explaining the Panther 10-point program, which talks about housing and better health care and employment. And I jump up in the middle of his lesson, and I said, I'm ready to be a Panther. Give me a gun. I'll kill a white cat right now. And the whole room gets quiet, and he calls me up, reaches into the bottom drawer of the desk. I think he's going to give me the biggest gun ever. And he does hand me a stack of books. And I said, I thought you were going to arm me. And he said, I just did. He said, and by the way, if all of the cops who were beating people up and brutalizing them were black, and all of the storekeepers that are exploiting people with inferior products and high prices, and all of the senators and the congressmen, everybody in power was black, and people being oppressed were white, would that make things correct? And I said, no, it seems like it would still be wrong. He said, that's right. This is a class struggle for human rights, not just a race struggle. That was my first day in the Panther office. And yes, and as you said, I went to work in the breakfast program, and the Panthers had a free health clinic, and that was the majority of what you did. You know, day-to-day was like community service in these programs, but the Panthers very much did talk about aggressive social change and the fact that that there probably had to be, you know, class struggle and revolution in the country to redistribute the wealth for things to really get better.
You were arrested at 16. You spent 11 months at Rikers Island for your affiliation with the Panthers. You were then released on bail. You later spent 12 years in prison for hiding fugitives wanted on federal robbery and conspiracy charges. And you write about both experiences in the book, and I would like to talk to you a little bit about how prison changed you. But do you feel you were there legitimately, or do you still feel that it was a bum rap? Even though you call it Leavenworth University, do you feel that it was justified for you to be in prison?
Well, the Panther 21 case was a clear frame-up. The first time that I was arrested, along with 20 other Panthers, the cops kicked in our door around the city, and that was weapons charges, and they said that we were planning, it was a bomb conspiracy case. They said the Panthers were planning to plant bombs at certain stores and at the botanical gardens, and that was based on the testimony of two undercover cops who were part of an elite police unit. And one of the other undercover cops was actually a Panther officer who was my mentor, who taught me a lot about being a Panther, just to show you how those kind of cases work. And that those were clearly framed up charges, and it took a 2.5-year court battle for the Panther 21 to be acquitted of all of those charges. The Leavenworth charges, in terms of, you know, being part of a modern underground railroad that were helping former Panthers, but also people from white organizations and Latino organizations, you know, get identification and get out of the country and do that stuff, were actually true. I was part of this modern underground railroad. And when you help someone who is on the run from the FBI, you can get half of what they're facing. So the people they were looking for in terms of bank robbery, you get, which carries 25 years, I got 12 and a half years. Did I feel that amount of time was justified? No. If it was a white-collar crime, and this is true if you just look at the socioeconomics of prisons even to this day, someone from a wealthier background who might be white gets caught with a small amount of drugs or marijuana, might get probation. A black kid from an urban community gets caught with some marijuana and some drugs. They said that he was selling the drugs, and they get 5 to 10 years in prison and a life of forever ruin. So I did feel, even in my own place, that kind of class contradiction. And also I felt like I was a prisoner of conscience, that I was helping people who were radical people who were protesting change in the government kind of get away. Even so, I was sent to the toughest prison that they could send you to, which was Leavenworth. Although I was married and I had a son, an infant son with sickle cell anemia, and was supposed to be at a what they call a federal prison camp as opposed to maximum security. But it did turn out to be an amazing experience in terms of being able. University of Kansas had a program where you could earn, bachelor's and master's degrees and even a PhD in certain subjects. And they came in every night and treated us just like their students on main campus, which means they worked us hard. In fact, there was one woman who was an English professor that the guys who were weightlifters and lifers and bikers and all of that were scared of, and she was a petite woman in her late 60s. She would mark your paper up and tell you could do better. One time she came in with the Bible redlined with grammatical errors. And we were sitting in the back going, like, she just redlined God, man. What are we supposed to do? But it shows you that when people care and they recognize your humanity, that that it makes a difference. And everyone who was in the college program, I mean, all of the statistics show that that the more education a prisoner has an opportunity to get, the rate of recidivism lowers proportionately for obvious reasons. And even for someone who's doing life, why give them a college education? Guess what? That person gets to write their son, their little brother, their nephew, and go, dear son, you know I haven't been there, I know I've been making mistakes, but look at what I'm doing now. And we could study together. Send me your term paper. You know what I mean? Let's talk right about books that we could read. So it begins to break the cycle in that way.
In prison, in learning, in going after 3 degrees during that time and becoming educated, you, as I mentioned, the subtitle of the book is A Life of Rebellion and Reinvention. Did the reinvention for you consciously start at that point?
Well, it really did. The other thing that I got involved in was theater. I had done a little bit of theater through the Black Arts Movement, you know, right when I was in the Panthers. And, you know, there were, you know, people like Sonia Sanchez and Amiri Baraka writing, you know, wonderful plays of political consciousness, and I did a little acting. And one day a couple of black prisoners came around me and they said, "Man, you did plays out there?" And I, the way they did it, I thought I did something wrong. And I went, "Yeah." It was like, "Well, do something, man, for Black History Month." And I wrote this play, and I had a couple of prisoners that I was had to teach, you know, about acting, even as we were doing. And guys from the Latino gang came in, and Leavenworth, like most maximum security prisons, are highly segregated. The men stay to their own, right? So you have a section of the yard where there's Latino prisoners, black prisoners, white prisoners. Nobody mingles. And there's a lot of tension and a lot of hatred. Here come the two leaders of the Latino gang. And we all thought, there was about four of us, these guys have left their section of the yard. They were doing life, and they had a couple of murder charges since they were in prison. We thought, who are they here to kill? And Rafael is, you know, is the leader of the Latino gang. He sits like on a little milk crate, and he's watching me intently working with these guys. And we're, you know, trying to play it cool, watching out the corner of our eyes. And after about 10 minutes, he jumps and he points at me, and he's really upset. And he was like, "Let me speak to you, man." And he pulls me to the side. And he's like, "Essay, we heard rumors about what's going on here, and we had to check it out. And I'm going to tell you something, and you listen to me good. That guy you're working with, that guy, Essay, he's not feeling his character." So I said, "Well, why don't you do it?" And he was great, and he made his friends get involved. Then the white prisoners came because they thought the blacks and the Latinos were teaming up against them. And they got involved, and we became our own courtyard. We had men through theater who were talking to each other. We wrote this play. The Black History Month play, that went out the window. We did some other play where everybody was involved. And then we got some of the same guys to take college classes. There was communication and trust that wasn't there. And I realized at that moment that I wanted to use arts and education as a tool for social change. I thought the revolution had ended. I thought that, you know, in the Panthers we had the shotguns, the law books, and the pancakes batches for the breakfast program. And I saw living proof of my time in Leavenworth that arts and education could also be a powerful weapon for social change.
Was it just fate that you wound up once again at Columbia, or was that a goal, or
no? Yeah, no, it was fate. I came out and I started working in community programs, and I started doing my plays just in community theater for no money at first, and then was fortunate that I started to build a bit of a reputation as a playwright and a director, and then through there people started asking me to write and then direct small education films for black student audiences, and a couple of those films got some attention and won awards, and I wound up applying and getting a fellowship at Sundance Film Institute and for a screenplay that I had written about, not my life, but about the Black Panther Party. And I met people there who became friends and mentors who were working, who were, you know, writers and directors and producers in Hollywood. And that's how I started, being able to do some stuff for, some of the networks and HBO, et cetera. James Shamus, who now runs Focus Features, was a Columbia professor, and we became friends at Sundance. And I was invited by him to come apply for a teaching job, to teach one semester at Columbia. And it turns out that the person who was chair of the department had been one of the leaders of SDS, Professor Lewis Cole, and was a brilliant film professor. And they allowed me to teach one semester and then invited me back. And I found that I really enjoyed it, that the students responded, and that the School of the Arts was a place where my art and my activism was, you know, was fine. It was fine for me to be Jamal Joseph and to be this activist person and to teach people screenwriting and filmmaking, and then wound up being there. The ironic part is that that's a place where I used to show up as a young Panther and give speeches on campus, you know, when the students had shut the campus down and, call Columbia a bourgeois institution, and then if they didn't support, you know, the ending of the war in Vietnam and progressive change, then these students should not just take it over. They should just burn this damn place down.
Do you feel that film and screenwriting are powerful tools for an advocate and an activist?
I think they're very powerful tools. I think and I talk to my students about this because not everyone wants to make a social justice film, and so that's not what I teach. You know, I try to sit with students to talk about what it is that they want to do. But for those students who do, I think it's important to make those kind of films where you care about the characters as people, and then you'll care about what they're fighting for, whether it's a film like Erin Brockovich or Norma Rae, where you see these powerful women, you know, activists, or whether it's the HBO film of Boycott, where they talked about Martin Luther King and the Montgomery bus boycott. What they did was humanize those characters and made us care and just do it. But yes, so much of what we get, people are reading less, and as an author, I'm a little distressed by this, but we certainly are watching television, we're watching films and television shows, not only on our smaller screens at home, but on our personal devices, on our iPads and our phones. And it's a very, very powerful medium, and you could do things like people did with the Coney video that goes viral and brings a whole generation into focus about something that's going on, such as the war crimes in Uganda, or even with the Trayvon Martin case, how things are going viral on the internet. And it's making people think about not only that case, but, you know, within communities, around the country, about the relationship between, the police and young black men. And, you know, a quick sidebar, I was just at a discussion last week with a friend who was a doctor. He was in the Black Panther Party, and he was a doctor. And the police stopped him, and he said, look, I'm a physician. And he's in his 50s. He says, I'm a physician. He says, I have my stethoscope in my bag. And the white cop says, yes, and I have a gun in my car. Turn around.
Wow.
So stories that kind of bring this into focus and to let us know that 45 years after the Black Panther Party and after, you know, the Civil Rights Movement, all of that, that we still have these issues that we have to address. I do think film and television can help bring these things into focus.
Jamal Joseph's book is Panther Baby. It's published by Algonquin. Jamal Joseph, a great pleasure to have you on the program. I wish you all the luck in the world. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure. Have a great day.
And to you.